making do in Cuba on $15 a month.
When I realized how much I had spent, I paid 60 cents for this pizza. And this was such a catastrophic mistake. Like, to impulsively spend 60 cents on, you know, the equivalent of one slice of pizza, I broke down crying.
That's journalist Patrick Sims. We talked to him about his article in the October Harper's Magazine, 30 Days as a Cuban, Pinching Pesos and Dropping Pounds in Havana. In the second half of the show, we'll air a 2008 interview I did with T.J. English about his book, Havana Nocturne. It's about how the mob took over Havana and lost it to the revolution. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rianna. In September, Fidel Castro told an American journalist the Cuban model doesn't work anymore and says the system needs changing. He tried to backtrack on his remarks a few days later, but then, a week later, the Cuban government announced it would be laying off 500,000 workers and encouraging the growth of small businesses. It was a momentous shift toward allowing private enterprise in what has been a tightly controlled state economy since the revolution of 1959. I first visited Cuba in 1970. I went with a group of about 100 young Americans who wanted to show their support for the Cuban Revolution by cutting sugarcane in the big harvest. It was called the Venceremos Brigade. At that time, all Cubans had enough to eat, prostitution was non-existent, and most people had too much money, not too little. With housing, health care, and education free, a ration system that provided adequate food, and not a whole lot of consumer goods to buy, money wasn't a problem. But then the Soviet Union collapsed, and Cuba lost the billions in aid that had been propping up its economy when the U.S. embargo choked off trade. It was called the special period, when people really went hungry. Then Cuba opened up its doors to foreign tourists and their currency. The Cuban economy split in two between those who had access to dollars and those who had only Cuban pesos. It means that now about 80% of Cubans struggle to make ends meet. My guest, Harper's Magazine writer Patrick Sims, decided to find out what it's like to live on the wages of a Cuban journalist, $15 a month. It wasn't easy. He spent most of his time scrounging for food and lost 11.5 pounds in the process. He tells his story in the current issue of Harper's. It's called 30 Days as a Cuban. I started out by asking Patrick Sims what it was like to live on $15 a month.
Well, by our standards, that's a very small amount of money indeed. In the Cuban system, it goes a lot further than it would in other places because there are many subsidies to life in Cuba, so no one in Cuba has to pay rent at all. Or, you know, the cost of visiting a doctor is nothing. They do have to pay for medicines and so on, even at the same price as we do sometimes. But in general, certain things in Cuba can be extremely cheap or free. And even so, 15 bucks does not go very far. There's millions of Cubans who live on $12 a month. There's even many retirees who are on pensions of $8 a month. So that's a very long 30 days to live on $8 or $12 or even $15 like I did. I saw the national average salary is a little under $20, and the best paid people in Cuba are doctors who make about $30 a month. And I did one time meet a woman who was paid better than that, and she was the director of the most important museum in Havana, the most important art museum. And she told me she made the equivalent of $45 a month. And I'd never heard of anyone making so much money. And I said to her, wow, that must be, you know, you're all set. And she said, oh, no, it's almost impossible to get through the month on $45.
Well, almost impossible. What you found is that people really have to work outside the system in order to do that. But before we talk about that, let's talk about the system itself. You zero in on the ration system. You say that Cuba, I believe, has had the longest running ration system. Here we're talking about food rationing in the world. It's been going on since the beginning.
Yes, since about 1960. Some things were rationed by 1960. Their system was in place by 1962, and it's varied very little. It's a system, what they call for a distribution system for basic goods, like rice and beans and bread and oil and flour. And the way the system works is every household has a ration book, a libretta, with categories in it for dozens of types of goods. Usually only a much narrower range of things are actually available. And you go to your local corner store or bodega. These are all state-run, like all stores in Cuba, they're state-run. Everyone is basically identical. It has a chalkboard listing the goods that are in stock on the ration, and then there's a second smaller chalkboard listing some goods that are available off the ration, and it gives the price. And the prices are very subsidized, so that every family, each person will get maybe 4 or 5 pounds of rice a month, and the first pound of rice costs 1 penny. The second, third, and fourth pounds of rice, you know, cost about 4 pennies a piece. So you're going to spend for 20 cents, you can get a month's worth of rice. So that's a big help in getting through the month on, you know, these tiny salaries that Cubans have. But notably, that's just about as much rice as you could eat in a month. It just gets you through. It ekes you through almost. Actually, I'm exaggerating that. It's not quite enough to get through the month. And there really isn't that much else on the ration, and you do have to end up going off the ration to get probably the majority of the food you will eat in a month. That is to say, the ration is merely a social safety net, very basics. Many Cubans told me that it contains enough calories to last about 12 days. And after that, you know, the old joke in Cuba is we have a mixed economy now where socialist for the first half of the month and capitalist for the second half. So it's not so much of a joke. I guess that's why they find it funny, because it's not so much of a joke. You literally run out of food and have to go out into a different outside system. And there are legal ways to buy food, both, you know, get a little more food out of the state system. Then there are dollar stores that are everywhere in Cuba now that, you know, there was a time that was unheard of. And throughout the 1990s and the last decade, it's been growing, and now every neighborhood in Cuba has a dollar store. And if you have dollars and can pay these much higher prices, you can get anything. But, of course, people don't have dollars. So those systems don't really solve your problem, and that leaves us with, as you put it, going outside. The black market, the obsession of all Cubans now is how to make a little extra money to get through the end of the month to buy some food. And the most common way to do that is through stealing. The state controls almost everything in Cuba, including all the resources and all the food stores and all the supplies for everything. All enterprises are state enterprises. And so basically people just loot the state economy and the official economy in order to create a second informal black market economy. And in my case, the real lesson of my month in Cuba was that it's quite literally true that the first half of the month is socialist and the second half is capitalist, because I ran out of food and money when I still had a long time to go in my month.
You know, I was really shocked reading your story, which is in this month's issue of Harper's Magazine. Because I went to Cuba in 1969, 1970. I was in the 1st Venceremos Brigade, and I went back a couple of years later. So I'd say I've spent all told probably about 3 months in revolutionary Cuba. It was a long time ago. It was before the special period when the Soviet Union collapsed and of course, pulled out of Cuba. And I didn't see anybody scratching for food. People, in fact, had too much money. There were not enough goods to spend it on, but food was not a problem at all. Prostitution was unknown, and people didn't steal. And now people are having to steal. Women are selling their bodies in order to get enough food for their children. It seems that this is a profound threat to the society.
It is a sad trajectory. I think many Cubans look back, particularly in the 1970s, as a golden age when there was a kind of material, there was a functional system, and there were resources, and part of that was these subsidies coming from outside through the Soviet Union, but there was also, you know, just a rock-solid idealism, and that still exists in some ways in Cuba, but, you know, you mentioned the idea of stealing and not stealing, and I remember when I got to the Cuba much later than you did, but in the early 90s when I started going, and people were just very hungry during that special period. I mean, skinny, desperate for food. And I went to a school at lunchtime without announcement, just walked into a school, and the children, at a time when everyone was hungry and no one had any food and there was no meat available anywhere, the kids were eating ham salad and peas and fresh bread. And people, I saw that, and I was very impressed. And I thought, wow, you know, in the midst of this terrible crisis where people are, you know, eating their pets, children in schools are still getting these things. And people were very proud of that and say, yes, we don't steal from our schools. We don't take from kids. You know, we're a revolutionary society. And now I was very surprised on my month-long stay in Cuba to be constantly offered things that were stolen from schools. Food that people just openly discussed. Oh, yeah, my neighbor is a teacher. She stole this from the cafeteria at the elementary school, and that's how I would get chicken. And this was people sort of say, oh, gosh, I guess we shouldn't. But I think they've accommodated themselves to this ever-growing sort of culture of, you know, it really is necessary to survive for everyone, even me, to go into that criminal underground. And I was very... You know, the first night I was in Cuba, I talked with a man who told me he said, of course my salary is too low. I can't possibly survive. The only way I survive is I steal 5 liters of gasoline every month. Because I drive a car for the state, and I take gasoline out of the tank, and that's how I survive. And he said, words to the effect, what am I leaving for my son? What kind of a country are we leaving for my son where he sees his father stealing every month? That's what his father does to survive, is be a criminal and steal. And what kind of a society are we leaving for these kids? And I always admire and respect Cubans because they have such high aspirations. It's such a touching thing to see this country that is relatively poor by our standards, by no means poor as poor gets in Latin America or elsewhere, but that people were lifting themselves up and seeing the revolution as a vehicle for higher education, for cultural attainment, for material advances. And to lose some of that and to lose the idealism and to see it dribble away in this, you know, endless game of sort of making people steal to survive, which I think ultimately is what's happening. The state has left people with no option. And that is really a form of betrayal of the idealism that was so present in 1958 to 1959 when this first came to pass.
We're talking with Patrick Sims. His article in the October issue of Harper's Magazine is 30 Days as a Cuban, Pinching Pesos and Dropping Pounds in Havana. First of all, I guess the question comes to my mind is, how did this happen? Do you feel that there are issues of corruption? I mean, after all, it's 1989 was, 21 years ago. Cuba's had a long time. Yes, people will say, well, of course, the U.S. has had an embargo on Cuba, which has been pretty devastating, but the rest of the world trades with Cuba. So how did this happen?
Well, you know, I think there's a sort of grinding, inexorable logic to the revolution, which is survival. And there's one, you know, positive aspect to that, survival at any cost for the system, which, you know, is Wayne Smith, who was the top American diplomat in Havana in the 1970s, has argued that, you know, in the end, Fidel Castro succeeded in one goal, which was to make Cuba truly independent of the United States. Of, you know, Cuban history is this long trajectory of trying to sort of get away from Spanish control. Then the U.S. came in. 1959 was really about sort of getting out from under the thumb of the United States. So he has established great independence through the strategy, anything to survive, anything to stay in power, no compromise, never let anyone else do that. And, you know, 50 years later, I think that that project is successful. Cuba is independent and sovereign. But that's really the only upside to trying to survive at any cost. And in the meantime, the survival strategy sort of forces people to shut down. It doesn't allow for reform and gradual changes. Reforms have been introduced hundreds of times in Cuba. They're constantly discussing that we're going to have reforms, and they never go anywhere, and they never get done. And there are not these new forms of doing things. It's because the system needs to perpetuate itself and puts itself first. And really, the system is just about shutting down now any threat to itself in order to preserve that independence and sovereignty for Cuba. They've sold the idea that they have no one can really criticize or anything, and that's a betrayal of the revolution if you say our economic system needs to change today. Now, this is changing a little bit because they have now, you know, I think it was in September, Raúl Castro introduced talk about reforms and self-employment and being able to open businesses, and that's a crucial psychological change in Cuba, especially if they just allow people to start solving their own economic problems and fixing things and making money on their own, which has always been very threatening to the revolution because it creates power bases. When people have money and are independent, they're not controlled. And indeed, many opposition activists and human rights activists and democracy activists in Cuba say that the ration system and the distribution of food is really a control system. It's a mechanism for making everyone line up and participate in the system and do what they can to get the extra little bits of food or financial support that they need out of the system. And it forces everyone to cling to the revolution so that the ration system itself, instead of being a social safety net that many countries should have, you know, it'd be great. There's countries all over the world that are worse off than Cuba. You know, Ethiopia should have a ration system like Cuba has, where they're giving away rice for virtually free. But in Cuba, it's become a sort of powerful tool for the state, and it's become a trap. It's a self-reinforcing trap, and there is less and less food on the ration system, less and less through the state system now than before, even though I think actually there is more food overall in Cuba, thanks to various programs to create some farmers markets and to import a huge amount of food now. Even one-third of all food in Cuba comes from the United States now.
Yeah, this is, I wanted to ask you about some of these that you just talked about, these alternatives to rationing. You went to a market, to an agro, as you call it, a kind of a farmer's market, but not exactly like the farmer's markets we have. Describe it for us.
Well, it's, yeah, farmer's market is not quite the right term for it. They are state-run markets where, you know, a basic array of food is available at prices much higher than the ration, although they're not neither cheap nor expensive. You know, the prices are set by the state. The goods are, you know, the whole system is really controlled by the state, including, you know, which goods are available. But they do provide, you know, that's where the legitimate food comes from and the legitimate opportunity to feed yourself in the second half of the month when your ration rice has run out. The prices are still fairly steep. I mean, I never bought, I guess in the end on the black market, I bought some meat. I bought some chicken patties, but that had, you know, chicken patties that had no chicken in them, but that was stolen food. I never could afford meat, you know, at the agros where they have a special room over on the side where they're just selling pork. And then there's a main room full of, you know, basic vegetables, tomatoes, peppers, onions, particularly the root foods, the manioc and sweet potato, that people live on in Cuba. So they're there, they exist, and that's how Cubans must survive now, is going to these places, but it still doesn't solve the equation of where do you get the money to go buy your you know, even a small amount of meat or just some potatoes and sweet potatoes and things.
And where do they get their money?
Well, many Cubans, you know, about 10% of Cubans live in exile now. So a lot of people get money from abroad, a small amount once in a while, but a small amount can go a long way in Cuba. The tourism industry is big in Cuba, so that creates a lot of situations where, you know, a waiter is getting tips from foreigners, or people are working in businesses to do with foreigners, and they have a chance to make money one way or another. Prostitution is very common, routine. Cuba is a global sex tourism destination. It is how many, many women survive and meet their need. Young women just routinely look either for a foreign boyfriend to, so they can make some money to get through the month, or a foreign boyfriend they can marry to get them out of the country. It's very common that young women see, you know, getting out of the country as the solution to this. And prostitution in the 1990s, like hunger in the 1990s, was worse than today. But it's still everywhere. And I talk in Harper's about, you know, a long set of discussions I had with a prostitute who walked by my house every day and used the same ration store I was using. And, you know, she didn't have a lot of choices. She's working as a nurse. And they, you know, nurses don't get paid very much in Cuba. You're going to probably the national average, but $18 or something, and can't survive on that. And she told me she had a young child. So what are you going to do? She had a little daughter. She said she's very precious to me. And so she would work long shifts at her job, save up money in the province where she worked, or save up, that is to say, bank hours at her job, and then take a vacation and go to Havana and be a prostitute. And that was where she made her money to survive in various ways. And, you know, that's just a bad equation. It should not be the case. When Fidel Castro was on trial in the 1950s, and he gave his most famous speech ever, "History Will Absolve Me," and he specifically says in there that the goal of for our revolutionary movement should be to attempt, he didn't say they could do it, but to attempt to eliminate prostitution completely. And it not only failed, but it's become this, you know, a survival strategy for the island. Basically, prostitution is keeping a huge number of Cuban families fed and clothed.
She gave you, I think, a penny so you could make a phone call to her. She was really, and then you had to use it because you completely ran out of money.
Yes,
you used it to get the cab, was it, or the bus to take you?
The bus out to the airport. No, I didn't take a cab during a whole month in Cuba. I rode the buses, including to and from the airport, and lived that whole month on just a little over $15 by either walking or taking buses. And she did, the prostitute gave me a coin. And she said, "This is so you can call me, so we could have a little rendezvous." But instead, I kept the coin as my emergency reserve, and that's the price of one bus fare. And several Cubans, you know, many Cubans, helped me out. And, you know, normally they see foreigners as having a lot of money, and they're asking for money. But as people got to know what I was doing and saw that I was living the way they do and going through it, they appreciated that and tried to support me. And people would give me a little snack or a bite of something to eat or invite me over to their house for a drink or something, and sort of kind of sort of cheer me on. You know, there's a limit to that. There's a limit to how much food they can give away. I noticed people who gave me a meal, if I came back 10 days later looking for another meal, they didn't give me one. So, you know, they do need the food. You're taking it away from their kids. So
We're talking with Patrick Sims about his article, 30 Days as a Cuban, Pinching Pesos and Dropping Pounds in Havana. It's in the October issue of Harper's. And it is, I had to say, I was struggling along there with you, although not literally. You were counting the meager calories. You were counting the days, counting your pennies. It's quite a process. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, you know, it was a real lesson in how exhausting it is for Cubans to be Cuban, to survive in this system, because you have to calculate every day each penny, literally each penny. You know, people are very, very careful with each penny because it represents such a serious commitment. And you know, I struggled as the month was going on. My little supply of rationed food was wearing down. I had, you know, my sort of $15, which I spent on food, basically, almost exclusively on food. And that wasn't really enough. And I, you know, I think when I had 17 days to go, I was down to $3.60. And I had this terrible crisis moment where I had taken a long walk, and I think my blood sugar was bottoming out, and I was past a little alley where there was a cardboard sign tucked into a door, and it said pizza. And I went and I knocked, and this is a typical thing for Cubans to be selling, you know, a sandwich or something on the side to make some money. And it was a very basic, small, you know, equivalent of one good New York slice, not very delicious or anything. And I impulsively ordered one without really thinking about the cost, and I went back to the apartment where I was staying and put the little tiny pizza on the counter. And when I realized how much I had spent, I'd paid 60 cents for this pizza. And this was such a catastrophic mistake, like to impulsively spend 60 cents on, you know, the equivalent of one slice of pizza. I broke down crying. And, I just lost it. And I had to go sit down, and I was bawling my eyes out because I had made this huge mistake that gravely affected my chances. You know, I had 17 days to go, and I just blew a fifth of my money in this sort of impulsive. For the same amount of money, I could have got pounds and pounds of rice. So it was this terrible mistake, and I was crying. And it really drove home to me, you know, the psychological duress of poverty anywhere, where you're always, you know, scratching out numbers on the back of a piece of paper trying to figure out, well, if I spend X on this thing, how much can I spend on that thing, and making these terrible trade-offs. And it's a great pressure on any person who's poor and is counting every penny. And certainly for Cubans, what's unique about Cuba is there is, you know, there are people struggling to get food all over the world. But in Cuba, there is no other way. There is no permitted alternative. It's not as if you have a society where some Cubans are doing well and some are very poor. You don't have haves and have-nots. Everybody is equally poor.
Well, you have some. You point out that there are people at the upper echelon who nobody even sees.
Yes. There is now starting to be... Cubans are obsessed with a topic that you don't hear much about in the official media, which is corruption. Because in the past, there was this idealism. There was a tightly controlled society where financial corruption was almost unheard of, loathed by the government and persecuted. You know, the corrupt officials would be taken out and shot in Cuba. But now that's starting to change, and there are all these foreign companies headquartered in Havana and the tourism business and so on. Suddenly there are more Cubans in positions of power and influence where large amounts of resources are flowing through their hands, and you hear but never see that there are suddenly people who have money and they're kind of hidden away in their houses and nice houses in the suburbs of Miramar and Playa. And behind their fences, they're living well, and they can't show it, though. There's not a lot to spend your money on in Cuba because officially everyone is equal. It's not the reality anymore. And this is still a very tiny phenomenon. The vast majority of people are not even really a middle class. There's just a sort of proletariat status where the vast majority of people are surviving on that salary plus any money they can get from a relative abroad or something. It's still only just a tiny number who have entered this new elite.
It's such an irony because, as I think one of your interlocutors said, Osvaldo Paya, is that?
Mm-hmm.
He's a dissident in Cuba. He said, the paradox is that the workers are the poorest people in Cuba. We're all worse off than the guy who sells hot dogs in the gas station. And, you know, when I went and visited Cuba, you know, there was a real commitment, I think, on all levels. And we did know people at all levels of the government because we were kind of on an official trip. But we got to go around and talk to just ordinary folks as well. There was such a commitment to the workers.
And, you know, I think the reason you have a lot of hunger in Cuba, but you don't have any revolutionary movement in the streets. Nobody's throwing bricks through windows. Nobody's attacking the government. And it is, in a modest and sort of genteel way, technically a police state where no opposition is permitted. But you don't see tremendous resentment or hatred of the government. And the reason is because of that solidarity and that idea that people are committed to the least in the society, to the ordinary person, to the worker. And that's the birth of the Cuban Revolution. Maybe it's heavily a rhetoric now, but it's important that they still talk about that, and the majority of people are in it together. Everyone, I say everyone is equally poor. That elite of corrupt officials at the top is very small. I would guess that 95% of Cubans are in a sort of huge lower class proletariat group who are living on this system. And because they feel that we're all in this together, so people are willing to kind of put up with very difficult circumstances because they don't feel that it's hypocritical.
So now you lost about 10 pounds in 30 days. Have you gained it all back?
I lost 11 and a half pounds in 30 days. I have gained back about 8 pounds of it, which was amazingly easy and pleasurable. Aside from losing 11 and a half pounds, one of the things I lost in Cuba was any feeling of sort of guilt about food. And we live in a society where people are fascinated by food and food culture is so important now, and people have ambivalent feelings about it and wonder, is this a bad food? Is too much? Are we spending too much? Do we have too much abundance? Do we feel guilty about this food or that food? All that feeling disappeared for me. And I came back, I'll eat anything. Sure, let's have another bottle of wine.
Well, Patrick Sims, your article is 30 Days as a Cuban, Pinching Pesos and Dropping Pounds in Havana. It is a terrific read, and thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Francesca.
Patrick Sims writes about Latin America and other topics for Harper's, Outside, and Condé Nast Traveler, among others. He's also the author of Chasing Che and The Boys from Dolores, about Fidel Castro's schoolmates and what's happened to them. You can read his article, 30 Days as a Cuban, by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, we air a 2008 interview I did with T.J. English about his book, Havana Nocturne. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Don't go away.
Cuando se alzó mi bandera, la tuya lo haría igual y fue, sabes, la primera que juntos quisimos volar. Más tarde una voz amada gritó con mucha razón, Cuba y Puerto Rico son de un pájaro las dos alas. Cuba y Puerto Rico son de un pájaro las dos alas. Puerto Rico, ala que cayó al mar, que no pudo volar, yo te invito a mi vuelo y buscamos juntos el mismo cielo.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. In the first half of the show, we found out what it's like for an ordinary Cuban today. It's not easy, but it is a lot easier than it was before the revolution. Healthcare, education, and decent housing were out of reach then for most Cubans. The brutal regime of Fulgencio Batista kept the peace for the Cuban elite and for the comfort of American corporations like United Fruit. And for the mafia. T.J. English wrote about the mafia's plundering of Havana and how the revolution ended it in his book Havana Nocturne. I spoke with him about it in 2008. T.J. English, welcome to Writer's Voice.
My pleasure.
Now, in your book Havana Nocturne, you talk about how the mob had always dreamed of one day controlling their own country. Why did they pick Cuba to do this?
Well, part of that was the proximity of Cuba to the United States, the fact that it is just 90 miles off the coast of Florida, that it's a pretty easy jaunt to Cuba and back for anyone from the Eastern Seaboard in particular, but pretty much anywhere in the United States. So that was one reason, but more importantly was the island of Cuba's history of dictatorship and repression and corruption, which had been a fact of life in Cuban political life throughout much of the 20th century. And so American mobsters who were particularly far-reaching in their thinking, people like Meyer Lansky and Charles Lucky Luciano and Santo Traficante and some of the others who were some of the guiding lights of the American mob, had this idea that if they could establish a relationship with a corrupt government in a place like Cuba, that they would have the political foundation to basically do whatever they wanted to do in that country.
And describe for us the Havana of those days. Put us there, or maybe put us in one of the nightclubs that were run by the mob.
Right. Well, by the time that the mob really realized their dreams for Havana, the plan that they had had for many decades, it came to fruition in the decades of the 1950s. And in that period, Havana became a kind of paradise, mobsters' paradise. It all started, of course, with the casinos. Casino gambling became the engine that drove the whole operation. The money generated by the casinos, fabulous wealth generated by the casinos, it's like a license to print money. And in Havana, there was no gaming commission or much regulation of the money coming into the casino. So the money came in and went into the counting rooms of the casinos, and from there it was went right into the private bank accounts or the pockets of the mobsters, and it was distributed to corrupt political officials. It was distributed to members of the secret police in Cuba, whose job it was to keep the Cuban rabble in its place. And so that money was what made it all happen. But the money from the casinos was also reinvested in the nightlife in Havana, in the fabulous nightclubs like the Tropicana nightclub, the Sanssouci nightclub. These were beautiful, gorgeous outdoor nightclubs in Havana. In the Tropicana was the stage for the floor shows was actually under the stars outside in the middle of a tropical jungle. It was very exotic. The nightclubs used a lot of Afro-Cuban culture in the, of course, the music and the dance and in the entertainment, which was very attractive and alluring and kind of exotic to the North American tourists and European tourists that went there. And stemming from that, you also had prostitution, a very elaborate sexual marketplace that existed in Havana, starting with street-level prostitution and, of course, all manner of brothels, from cheap brothels to very high-class brothels. And beyond that, it's sex shows, live sex shows in places like the Shanghai Theater, which was famous for its body live sex shows, and also sex salons. You could go to a private home in a nice neighborhood in Havana and see an intimate sex show that you might even be able to take part in. So these are just some of the dimensions of what the mob had created as a kind of almost a kind of Venus flytrap for tourists and corrupt politicians and business people that came down to Havana in these years of the 1950s.
That's a wonderful expression, a Venus flytrap, with a little bit of a double entendre there.
Yes, well, I use that expression mainly in relation to the manner in which the mob would seduce and corrupt political and business figures. And this is so important to understanding how the mob operates. One of the attractions of Havana was that American politicians, senators, congressmen, powerful businessmen would go down to Havana and they'd be treated like royalty. They'd be comped at the hotels and casinos. They had their pick of women while they were there, and many politicians partook of that. And one in particular, a young senator from Massachusetts by the name of John Kennedy. The mob would extend a kind of what seemed like graciousness, free gifts. They would bestow all that they had to offer in Havana on politicians and businessmen. And it was all a way to make them beholden to you, to corrupt them, to seduce them. And that was a big part of what the mob was creating in Havana in these years.
And that's what we call the fix.
Yeah, the fix was in. The president of Cuba, Fulgencio Batista, who was a very important partner in all of this, received a weekly cash payment of $1.28 million. That was his percentage of the casino skim on a weekly basis. And these are 1950s dollars, so, I mean, you can multiply that many, many times over to get at the kind of money we're talking about that was being generated there.
And you mentioned Kennedy. Why don't you tell us that anecdote?
Well, Kennedy was there in 1957, young senator from Massachusetts. He was there with a group politicians and businessmen. He was there as a friend of Senator George Smathers from Florida. It was Senator Smathers who introduced Kennedy to Lansky and Traficante in Havana, probably right out in the open. That also is part of the attraction of Havana, that you could go down there and rub shoulders with nefarious characters and underworld figures, and it wouldn't get you in the kind of trouble it would if you did that back home in the United States. The story is that Traficante sensed that the young senator had a yen for the ladies, and so he set Kennedy up to have a tryst, an afternoon tryst in a nice hotel in a nice neighborhood in Havana. The hotel is still there. I saw it when I was down there researching. What Kennedy didn't know was the room that he'd been set up in had a two-way mirror, and Traficante and an associate of his watched this tryst take place. And they talked about it often afterwards. Traficante told his attorney, Frank Regano, that he always regretted not having filmed it or photographed it in some way because it would have made terrific blackmail material.
Well, you know, there's another very shocking, just to take a little digression here. There's a shocking revelation you make in your book. You almost kind of tuck it into a few paragraphs there, and that is that, as I have to say, probably many of us have suspected for a long time. You say that there's some real indication that the mob was involved in the murder of John F. Kennedy.
Oh well, I'm not the first to point that out. I mean, that's a story somewhat separate from what I write about in this book, although I do mention it there at the end. I mean, I think part of the significance of this story of the mob in Havana in the 50s and the manner in which the mob was chased out of Cuba when the revolution took over is a key to understanding the animosity and anger and resentment that the mob would eventually feel towards Kennedy, creating the kind of blowback that led to the Kennedy assassination.
You mean, well, of course, the revolution happened quite a bit before Kennedy did. Are you saying then that the revolution, which was how the mob lost Cuba, you feel was connected to some of the policies that the Kennedys, through their party, was connected to?
Well, not necessarily, but there is a sequence of events here. The mob loses Cuba in 1959. Kennedy becomes president in 1960. The Bay of Pigs invasion takes place in 1961. The exile community in Cuba is very upset with the Kennedy administration. They feel that the Kennedy administration did not back up the invading army in the Bay of Pigs invasion and hung them out to dry. In the wake of the Bay of Pigs invasion, Kennedy vows that Cuba will one day be free. The Kennedy administration begins a joint CIA operation called Operation Mongoose, which is devoted to the overthrow of Cuban revolutionary government, the assassination of Fidel Castro. Many of these same mobsters who were involved in Cuba in the 50s form an alliance with the CIA to assassinate Fidel Castro. We get into a whole netherworld of criminal activity here. At the same time, John F. Kennedy makes his brother Bobby Kennedy attorney general. Bobby Kennedy begins a crusade against the mob in the early years of the Kennedy administration. The mob is angry because they feel they played a role in getting Jack Kennedy elected president. And so a lot of this anger and resentment that's brewing the mob towards Kennedy, the mob towards Cuba, the Cuban exiles towards the Cuban exiles in South Florida towards the Kennedy administration, out of this smoldering stew of different political motivations, you get the events that lead to the assassination.
Well, let's go back to now to before that time, go back to the subject of how the mob did take over Cuba for a while. Actually, I want to go back even a little bit further because you give some really fascinating biographical sections about the book, and you also talk about the development of the mob, which is so much connected in with some of these individuals you've already mentioned, Meyer Lansky, Santo Traficante, and Lucky Luciano, who you haven't talked about yet. Talk a little bit, let's start a little bit with Meyer Lansky, because he really seems to be the kingpin here.
Yeah, Lansky is the architect of the plan that the mob had for Cuba, and he was the one that initially formed the relationship with Batista that made it all possible. Way back in the early 1930s, we don't know exactly why or how this came about, but Lansky set his sights on Batista. Batista rose to be the head of the Cuban military in 1933 at the young age of 32, and it was then that Lansky made a trip to Havana and paid a cash bribe in cash. We know this from an associate of Lansky's who described it in one of Lansky's biographies. He claims to have accompanied Lansky when they delivered a suitcase filled with cash to Batista in 1933. This was a bribe. In a way, it was Lansky making an investment in Batista at a very early stage, designating Batista as the likely power in Cuba for a generation to come. And it was a smart bet. It would take decades for it to pay off because historical events kept getting in the way. But it turned out to be the key relationship that made everything possible. And Lansky's a fascinating character. He, unlike a lot of mobsters, gangsters in the history of the American underworld, he kind of saw himself as a legitimate businessman. He was not a man of violence or not someone who committed violence with his own hands, although that's not meant to exonerate him. I'm sure Meyer Lansky was in on the decision-making process that led to a lot of mob assassinations over the years. But for the most part, in his own personal and business life, he stayed above the fray. He interacted with politicians and other so-called legitimate businessmen, and that was the world that he preferred to circulate in. And so he also was very adept at making money for his partners. That was the key. That's why Lansky lived, unlike a lot of mobsters who wind up in prison or taken out in getting whacked, taken out in some kind of a mob hit. Lansky lived long enough to die of old age, and a lot of that was simply the fact that he made money for a lot of people over the years.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with T.J. English about his book Havana Nocturne, How the Mob Owned Cuba and Then Lost It to the Revolution. Well, you point out how he was, you know, he was the businessman, he was the rationalist, mm-hmm. the architect here. I found that one of the most interesting ideas in your book, and it made me think back to when The Godfather came out, the movie The Godfather, or the three movies The Godfather, and how I was impressed at that time with how the mob seemed to be a version of capitalism, kind of the underbelly perhaps, but really not that much different than any other corporation, except in the fact that it was illegal and directly murdered a lot of people.
Right, yes, you're right, and I think perhaps we've lost sight of this in a way. Historically speaking, we forget how powerful the American underworld became, basically from the years of the 1920s when Prohibition gave birth to organized crime as we would come to know it, created this massive framework of crime, created a criminal structure in which the money from booze, in the case of Prohibition, but in later decades also from gambling and narcotics, would be used to influence the political system to corrupt law enforcement. This is the modus operandi of organized crime in the United States that existed for many, many decades, from the 20s right up until the 1990s. And in these years of the 40s and 50s, with people like Lansky and Frank Costello and Lucky Luciano and others, the mob came to see themselves as a budding multinational corporation. That's really how they saw themselves, and they envisioned that there would come a time when they would have the power to influence elections. And that's part of what this operation in Cuba was all about, because Cuba was supposed to be merely the stepping stone, the first step in a kind of international framework where the mob would establish a base of economic power in places like the Caribbean and in South America and possibly in Europe. They would do it through the leisure industry, through casino gambling and things related to that. This would create incredible wealth that they could then use to influence the political structure. And yes, it was kind of grand, very grandiose in scope, and it was modeled basically on American corporate structure. Lansky and the others saw themselves as CEOs of a national corporation, and ultimately, hopefully for them, a multinational corporation. In fact, you know, there was a period in the American underworld where there was a violent separation between the new generation, the people like Lansky and Luciano, taking out the old world mobsters with roots in Sicily, kind of the more traditional mafia, Cosa Nostra, connected to the old country based on sort of a village mentality. No, the American version was to be a major corporation, and the heads of the mob were to be like CEOs. So it was the taking of American capitalism and adapting it to the underworld marketplace.
Well, maybe that new mob has now become, you know, much, much diminished in size. But you've looked at other crime syndicates also. You've written about the Vietnamese. So do you think that this model of kind of the underworld, the shadow capitalism, is one that is still vital today and still kind of interpenetrates into the more legitimate power?
Yeah, there's been books written about this. I think a lot of the, in the upper reaches of the underworld, the level at which organized crime has influence over laws and banking and all that kind of stuff, that to a large extent has been subsumed into the corporate, so-called legitimate corporate structure. And in fact, many of what were criminal rackets in the 30s and 40s and 50s are now controlled in some way by the corporate world or by the government. I could go down a laundry list of things.
Yeah, give us an example.
Well, when you were in the 30s and 40s, if you were someone who didn't have lived in a neighborhood and you were of not great means and you needed some quick money, you went to a loan shark. Well, now you have a credit card. You go to the bank. The numbers racket, for instance, what they called the policy rackets, you wanted to play the number, bet on the number. You would do that with a local policy boss. Now you do it through the state lottery. The state government controls that. Narcotics, if you wanted to get high, if you wanted to soften the edges in your life, you would smoke a joint, do some heroin, buy some coke. Now America is hooked on pharmaceuticals so that they get prescribed to them by the doctor, and the medical system and the government gets their piece of it. I would argue that many of the types of behavior that we used to designate as criminal activity when it was controlled by the criminals has now been legalized in some form or another and is regulated by the government and by private industry, and they are the ones that make the profit. So in the larger framework of corporate activity, I mean, this gets into a whole area of the degree to which corporations control the world economy in ways that the mob might have dreamed of. So in many ways, a lot of the activities of the underworld during what they call the glory years of the underworld, the 30s, 40s, and 50s, have now just kind of integrated themselves into the so-called legitimate world.
Well, and now back to Cuba. Of course, part of the story, a very large part of the story, is not only what happened to, not only what the mob did in taking over Cuba, but also how the mob got overthrown in Cuba, the
right.
Rise of the revolution. First, I'd like to ask you, is there a connection? Was there a way in which the control by Fulgencio Batista and the mob of Cuba actually heightened the contradictions that brought about the revolution?
Yes, I think so, exactly. And that was one of the most fascinating things to me about researching this book, and one of the reasons for doing this book, because it occurred to me, you know, that there have been many books and studies of the Cuban Revolution, and there have been some things written about the mob in Cuba during these years, not much, But it always astounded me that these things were the mob's exploitation of Havana and the revolution were unfolding at the same time, and yet historically we've always treated them as if they were sort of separate and unrelated events. And so part of the motivation of this book was to find the ways in which they fueled and influenced each other. And in fact, these two parallel stories are sort of unfolding on parallel tracks. You have the mob creating this empire in Cuba, in Havana, very specifically in Havana, while at the same time around the island, mostly outside of Havana, the revolution is brewing and gaining strength. And yes, I do believe that, you know, the Cuban Revolution, though it's a very complex event and is deeply rooted in Cuban history, it is true that the exploitation of Havana, what was taking the plundering of Havana, the turning Havana into one big bordello, as Castro sometimes referred to it, became a very powerful motivating symbol for the revolution. There's no question about that. It came to represent a kind of capitalistic plundering of the island that the Cuban people had come to resent over the many generations. And you see this in a lot of the literature of the revolution and the communications of the revolution through rebel radio and everything. The references to what was taking place in Havana, particularly the relationship between the mobsters and the corrupt Batista regime and the American corporate interests, who were also benefiting from this tourism boom that was taking place, this mob-generated tourism boom. To the revolution, it seemed as though it was these three forces, the corrupt politicians, the mobsters, and the U.S. corporations, were all one entity, that they were all in it together.
The United Fruit Company organized tourist junkets going down there. Was that right? Or Pan American Airlines? But
yes.
Wasn't United Fruit in on
Well, United Fruit was a power in Cuba throughout the 20th century, a power in Cuba and in Latin America. They owned the sugar plantations, controlled the sugar business. Pan Am was part owner of the most glorious hotel in Havana, the Nacional. And inside of the Nacional, you had a casino owned and operated by the Lansky brothers, Meyer Lansky and his brother Jake. So, you know, these are all examples of ways in which it seemed as though the American corporate interest and the mobsters were kind of benefiting each other in Havana.
Well, T.J. English, thanks so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice. It's your book is Havana Nocturne, How the Mob Owned Cuba and Then Lost It to the Revolution.
Okay, thanks a lot. I enjoyed the conversation.
T.J. English is the author also of Patty Whacked and the Westies and Born to Kill, America's Most Notorious Vietnamese Gang and the Changing Face of Organized Crime. Read an excerpt from Havana Nocturne at writersvoice.net.
Yo pisaré las calles nuevamente de lo que fue Santiago ensangrentada y en una hermosa plaza liberada me detendré a llorar por los ausentes. Yo vendré del desierto calcinante y saldré de los bosques y los lagos y evocaré en un cerro de Santiago a mis hermanos que murieron antes.
That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net for more about today's shows. You'll find links to more information, web-only features, and you can sign up for a podcast and get connected on Twitter and Facebook. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.